Sunday Takeaway with Sunil Badami.
Hi, Sunil Badami here, and it's great to have your company on Sunday Takeaway on ABC Local Radio. Can you believe it's that time of year already? Where did the year go? You know, it feels like it's just that mad rush to work Christmas drinks and school speech night is about to end. And I suppose if you're a bit like me, I guess your thoughts are turning to the cricket, the beach, and setting your email holiday message to, hey, if it's urgent, drop me a line in February. Do you spend all year planning your annual getaway or dreaming about where you'd go if you won the lottery? Or does the end of school and the start of the holidays fill you with dread as you rush from drinks to drinks and shop to shop, trying to buy all your prezzies and not put on too much weight, or in my case, not too much more? Well, it's time to go into holiday mode with us on The Takeaway. Today, we'll celebrate a very special bush Christmas in a little corner of the outback. We'll join a wonderful family offering some desperate people a chance to enjoy a proper Aussie summer holiday. And we'll get some tips from the travel writer of the year on how to get the most out of your next big trip. So get your togs on, slap on some sunscreen, and leave your cares behind as we go on holidays with Sunday Takeaway.
This is Sunday Takeaway on ABC Local Radio with Sunil Badami.
Doesn't that always get you in the mood? At School's Out by Alice Cooper on Sunday Takeaway with me, Sunil Badami, on ABC Local Radio. Well, it's a rite of passage for many Aussies like me, and maybe you too, pulling on a backpack and doing the grand tour of Asia and Europe, seeing places you'd only ever seen on telly, falling in love, breaking your heart, maybe getting the odd ill-considered tattoo, and generally experiencing the world. Well, for our next guest, a love of travelling has turned into a job which, apart from maybe working as a beer taster or massage tester, must be high on the list of dream jobs for all of us. Columnist and blogger Ben Groundwater, aka Fairfax Media's The Backpacker, is one of Australia's most widely read travel writers. He's a regular contributor to the City Morning Herald, the Sun Herald and The Age, and he's written for The Lonely Planet. And he's also the author of Five Ways to Carry a Goat, a memoir of his time touring the globe while staying with his readers. During his 10 years as a professional travel writer, Ben has schlepped his backpack through more than 70 countries. And this year, he was voted Travel Writer of the Year at the Australian Society of Travel Writers Awards for excellence. Of course, the ceremony was held in Fiji. Well, he's actually just flown in from Japan this morning, and he joins us in the studio today. How do I say hello in Japanese, Ben?
Well, it's morning, so ohayou gozaimasu.
Ohayou gozaimasu. Tell me, Ben, how do you become a travel writer? That's the first question I've got to ask.
Well, there's a number of, you know, everyone has their own story, I suppose. Mine was, I guess I did the traditional starting off in journalism. I studied journalism at university and kind of worked my way through a few different jobs doing some lifestyle stuff. And I worked on sport at the Sydney Morning Herald for a little while. And I'd always traveled a lot and always loved traveling. And I really enjoyed writing as well. So it kind of made sense to combine those two passions and sort of got to know the people who worked in travel journalism and started pitching stories and pitched the idea for the Backpacker blog. And that was about 9 years ago. And it's just sort of snowballed ever since.
So how did you first start traveling or catching the traveling bug?
I got it from my parents. You know, I They always travelled a lot. My mum's English, and so we'd always go back to her home a fair bit when I was young. My dad worked on ships since he was about 18, and so basically every country with a coastline he's been to. And, you know, he always had that in his blood and was always telling these stories about these amazing places that he'd seen and things that had happened. And I guess without realising it, I already had that passion for adventure from him.
So where was the first place you went to solo?
When I finished high school, a mate of mine, the two of us took a gap year and travelled together. And so we went to the US and travelled through there for a little while, staying with various kind of family friends and trying to have a soft landing, I suppose. And then we went down to the Bahamas and then over to do the UK thing and worked over in the UK for a while and did the old bus tour and all the cliches, basically.
It seems like I know that from the times I've been in backpacker hostels, you know, in Asia especially, you know, it's not enough to just go to Thailand. You've got to kind of cross the, you know, the Burmese border and start ferrying Karen rebels out. You know, there's kind of one-upmanship.
There's a bizarre competitiveness, which I've never really understood. But you get, yeah, when you're in a hostel and you start talking to people and you say, oh, I went to such and such, and they'll say, oh, did you see this monument? You'll be like, no, I missed that. Oh, you didn't even go there if you didn't see that. And, you know, there's this kind of feeling that people have that they need to impress upon you that they do travel better than you do, which is a bit weird.
So what place have you been to that you would say is the top of your list in terms of, where you know, the most memorable or most wonderful place you've ever visited?
It's really hard. It's a hard question to answer, but having just come back from Tokyo, even if I hadn't just come back from Tokyo, I would have that really high up on my list. It's such an incredible city. Where, I mean, I'm a guy who loves being in cities, and you know that's the biggest and most exciting and most traditional and most modern and strange city that you can hope to find. You know, anything you feel like doing, you can find a place to do it in Tokyo, basically. Anything you're into, anything you enjoy, anything you want to do, you know, you'll find somewhere in Tokyo to do it.
And is there a place that you'd love to visit? How many places have you actually been to in your travels, do you reckon?
In a kind of nerdy way, I totted it up the other day. I think it's 82 countries I've been to now.
Wow.
Yeah, but I mean, there are still fairly large chunks of the world that I haven't seen. You know, it's a big place. I haven't seen any of West Africa. I haven't seen a great deal of Central America. What I really want to do as my next sort of long trip is follow the old Silk Route from Iran up through the stands, you know, Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and into Western China, and do all that trip through by train. I think would be an amazing experience.
We actually talked to an adventurer who did all the stands on bike in our earlier episode on the bike, but I think train sounds a bit more sensible.
That's right.
Is there a place you'd never visit again?
There's not. I'd never rule anywhere out. I mean, there's places that I've enjoyed more than others and places that I haven't. You know, I spent a week in Bangladesh visiting a friend there, and it was a difficult experience.
Why is that?
Oh, I mean, I was in a train crash for starters. Which is not ideal. And you know, she lived in Chittagong, which is she was working for Care Australia, and basically Chittagong was rated. It's a city of, you know, million, I think almost 4 million people, but it's rated as a remote posting because there's just not really much infrastructure there for tourists or for Westerners. And it's just a huge experience, and it was a little bit overwhelming sometimes. And so when I left, I thought, you know, I'm glad I saw this, but I think I'm done with Bangladesh now. But you know, with the benefit of a bit of time, I would love to go back there and see it all again. And yeah, there's some amazing sights there. Like there's the shipbreaking yards just near Chittagong, which is, it's one of only two places in the world where old ships are basically taken apart bit by bit by hand on the beach. And it's incredibly dangerous for the people who are doing it. And it's, you know, terrible for the environment, but it's one of those unique things that you can't see anywhere else.
Tell me, what would your tips be? Have you ever been in a situation where you've gone, oh my God, I'm in a bit of trouble here? You know, it seems like, I think of that, the movie, The Castle, you know, where they said, yeah, oh, you know, the resort was a credit to the company and the food was great. And they're really boring travel stories. What's your most memorable travel story and how did it happen?
I've had a few near-death experiences, which usually, I suppose, make for good stories. You're right. And one of the things I was going to say about Bangladesh is, even though I didn't have a great time, I've got so many stories about my time there. And I've written so many stories about it because it's, you know, that's the good stuff. That's what's interesting. But I was in a train in Thailand once with my brother on a night train, and we were sort of chugging along down near Surat Thani in the south of the country at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And some sort of missile was fired through the window next to my head, probably about 20 or 30 centimeters away from where I was sitting. And smashed the window, and, you know, basically everyone in the train carriage started panicking and diving on the floor and covering their head. And I'm a really deep sleeper, and I was kind of groggy and sort of looking around at this broken glass and stuff. And I've said to my brother, it's probably just someone who threw a rock. And he pointed to the other side of the carriage, and he's like, no, I don't think so. And so whatever it was traveling fast enough to go straight through the carriage and smash a window on the other side. And there was a kid who was lying down on a wooden bench across the aisle from me, and if he'd been sitting up, it would have hit him. And it was horrible, and there was nothing we could do about it. And so the train sort of came to a stop, and a conductor came down and swept up all the glass, and there was a whole lot of talk, chatter in Thai about what had happened, which I couldn't understand a word of. And then the conductor pulled the blind down of the window that was smashed next to my head, and then the train kept on going, and that's the last we ever heard of it. We have no idea what happened.
There's kind of a theme here, and it train crashes, missiles through trains. Do you think maybe you should be reconsidering that train?
I love trains. I don't know what it is about it. I've got a real thing about trains, train travel. I did a 24-hour train trip in India, and it was one of the most interesting things I've ever done. You know, it's this microcosm of all these different parts of society, all these amazing people that you meet and things you see. It's such a better way to travel than flying, and you know, it's better than a bus because you can get up and walk around, you can go to a dining car, or you've got someone serving coffee coming through, and there's all these different people to talk to, and you're thrown into everyday life, basically, and I love that.
A lot of people on trains, being someone from India who went back to India with my family all the time, what I noticed was a lot of people kind of do that thing of, oh, well, I'll travel third class because it's more authentic, whereas most Indian people would like to travel first class if they could afford it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I probably would have booked first class for this trip if I could, but it was sold out, so I ended up in the in the plastic, unair-conditioned seats at the back with, you know, and it's just amazing. You know, people have paid and booked for seats, and there's people who jump on board who haven't. And everyone just sort of squeezes up and makes room for them, even though they've paid for their seats. And it's this really sort of communal atmosphere, and there's people running up and down the carriage selling food, and they jump off at one platform and more people get on, and so there's new food to check out, and everybody wants to ask you what you're doing there and what your dad does for a living and how much you earn and why you're not married yet and all that sort of stuff, and it's just really interesting.
Wow, that just sounds like family reunions to me. Now, tell me, what are your tips for really experiencing a place? Because often people say, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, you know, have you seen this? Have you done that? You know, countries are reduced to a list of things to be done. Have you done Italy? But how can we really experience a place when we're traveling through it?
I mean, I guess there's no foolproof way to do it. I would say, I think guidebooks are really great in a sense that they give you an idea of where the best places are sort of situated, like where there's going to be good restaurants or where there's going to be all the hotels and stuff are. So I think they're great for that. But the best thing to do once you figure that out is to not follow the guidebook and not to go to the restaurants that it tells you to go to, and you know, not to stay at the places or see the things. I mean, it's all a personal thing. And for me, I really love food, even when I'm at home. And so when I travel, food is a big thing for me. And I find some of the best ways to get that local culture and that real feel of what a place is like is just to wander around and go into a restaurant that maybe looks a bit dodgy, or maybe looks like somewhere that there probably won't be an English menu, or, you know, it just looks a little bit intimidating. I find those are the best places to just throw yourself in there. Someone will help you out to order the food that you need to get, and, you know, people will notice you and come and talk to you, and all of a sudden you're kind of getting a feel for what a place is like.
And it is really a great way to, I guess, become part of the local culture is when people from another country see you eating what they love to eat.
There's an
instant connection.
Yeah, and they're fascinated by it, and they want to share the things that they're into, and you know, particularly food. You know, they want to tell you about it, and they want to recommend other things for you to have. And you know, sometimes if places like Iran, people just invite you back to their house all the time because it's hospitable to do that, and they're very genuine about it. And you know, all of a sudden you've got these new friends, and you're seeing things that you never would have seen.
So tell me, 82 countries, Do you still get the deli belly, the barley belly?
Or? I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've met some travellers who say, "Oh, you know, I've been travelling so long, I've got an iron stomach now." But that is not the case for me at all. I mean, you know, when you go to a new place or even a place you haven't been to for a while, there's things in the water and things in the food and that you're just not used to. And I don't think there's any easy way around that, basically.
And what's the most memorable thing you've ever eaten?
Oh,
or unusual thing.
Unusual thing. I mean, there's, you know, when you're in Africa, you end up getting all sorts of bizarre animals served up to you. Like, you know, there's this weird thing of going out on safari and looking at these things like kudu and zebra and springbok and you know, appreciating their beauty and, you know, taking photos and being amazed by them. And then that night you go to a restaurant and they're on a plate in front of you and you eat them and you go, wow, this is delicious. Kudu is great. So there's that weird, I guess it's like scuba diving and looking at all the beautiful fish and then, you know, going and having a great seafood dinner that night as well. One of the strangest things, and a lot of people who go to Peru do this, one of their traditional dishes is guinea pig, which is kind of a rite of passage that you have to try. But I've always found it bizarre the way sometimes they serve them in a sort of running motion as if they're running across the plate, as if they're like actually trying to escape while they're put into the deep fryer. And so you get this whole fried guinea pig trying to sprint off the plate in front of you, which is a little bit weird.
This is Sunday Takeaway with Sunil Badami on ABC Local Radio.
And we're talking to The Backpacker, one of Australia's most widely read travel writers and the 2014 Australian Society of Travel Writers winner, Travel Writer of the Year, Ben Groundwater, who's giving us his tips on how to avoid deli belly, possibly not ordering the guinea pig, and making sure you don't have a window seat on a train in a war zone. So, Ben, look, I have to ask you, do you ever get tired of flying around the world and being on planes?
I do occasionally, yeah. And one of the things I've learned is that there's absolutely no point complaining to anyone about it because no one cares.
No.
But I mean, there's times, you know, I still love traveling. I get excited about going to places that I've never been and going back to places that I've loved. But, you know, there's times when there's flight after flight after flight and just security lines start to get to me and waiting at baggage carousels when everyone pushes past to get as close to the carousel as possible just in case their bag happens to come around. Those kind of things kind of start to annoy you after a little while. And, you know, I've never found a cure for jet lag, so...
Really? You've never found a cure for jet lag? Do you have any tips kind of ameliorate it?
There is one really good cure, and that's to fly business class.
Okay, so tell me, do you ever get tired of flying business class?
I actually don't fly business class very often, not nearly as much as I would like to. It's a very rare thing, so I still really appreciate it.
Do you know what, though? The one or two times I've ever been upgraded to business class, I've always found it really unrestful because I spend the whole time going, don't fall asleep. Yeah. The food comes on real plates. They're really nice to you. I can stretch out. Don't fall asleep.
Yeah. There's a wine list. I want to try it all.
Yeah. So what are your tips on being able to prepare yourself to go back to economy? Because I'm always happy to get on the plane because I only fly economy.
Yeah.
But the first economy flight after being on business class is very disappointing.
That's definitely the hardest part of business class is having to go back to the back of the plane. I don't know. I mean, I'm always so happy just to be going somewhere and seeing somewhere exciting or even coming home is exciting. It doesn't really bother me where I'm sitting in the plane, but I mean, it is a great, you know, it's so expensive to fly business class and I couldn't imagine ever justifying being able to pay for it myself. And I don't think anyone up there does really, you know, it's people on frequent flyer points or people whose companies have paid for them. But it does make a huge difference.
Now, you just come back from Japan and you were sent there by the resort that you was asking you to cover it. How do you cover as a journalist, you know, resorts or hotels that have paid for you to go there?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I find it really hard to have a bad experience when you're traveling. You know, everything's pretty great. It's, you know,
missiles and trains aside.
Yeah. Well, depending on, but generally the people who have the budget to send a travel writer over to come and see their resort or their country even, or, you know, they're good. They're good experiences. And so it's, you know, it's not like I need to make up some good stuff about a place like that. You know, I, I suppose you look for the good things to write about. I mean, I generally see, particularly weekend travel sections in the paper, people open them up and they want to know where to go, not where not to go, basically. So, I mean, if I go somewhere then and it is terrible, then I probably won't write about it rather than sort of slate it, I suppose.
So, but tell me, how do you balance, you know, I imagine they've flown you over, so you get the 5-star treatment. How do you balance the, you know, luxury of being in the resort and enjoying it with having to actually work and keep notes and write about it?
That's actually quite tough.
Again, my heart is going
I know. My friends are really sympathetic about this as well. I was saying to someone the other day, one of the worst parts about having a job that lets you travel is actually doing that job while you're traveling. Because, you know, you want to be out there enjoying things and looking at things, and that's what you're there for. But you have deadlines. You know, I've got two deadlines each week that I need to hit. So it's just a case of finding a space to work and a good time to work and trying to switch off all the fun stuff that you've been doing and just getting the writing done.
So for people like me who basically, you know, go away maybe once every 2 years, is your ideal holiday basically just staying at home in your UGG boots and weeding the garden?
It's actually not. I mean, I do really like coming home for a little while, but that lasts probably 3 or 4 days until I want to go away again. So on my holidays, I still want to travel, but it's kind of nice to be able to do exactly what I want to do and not have to think about what's going to make a good story and the things that I need to see. I just do exactly what I want to do, which is usually eat food.
Now, what would you never leave home without? What's an essential item? What tips would you have for someone who's about to go away?
A universal adapter for power is really handy. That's one of the first things. After my passport, that's probably the first thing that goes in my bag. Because yeah, everyone has a lot of electronic gadgets these days. It'd be nice to be completely unwired, but...
Can I add to that? A power board, like a multi-socket power board. So 3 or 4 of them, so you only need to take one adapter with you.
Yeah, it's a good idea. You can charge everything at once rather than, you know, doing one thing at a time. You can have your camera battery and your phone and, yeah.
So are you a light packer or do you try and...
I'm not an especially light packer. I mean, there's people who really pride themselves on being carry-on only travellers, you know, who can just take a couple of shirts and a couple of changes of underwear and they're all set. But I never really follow that. I just kind of take the clothes that I'm going to feel comfortable in. And I'm not someone who goes to the travel shops and buys up all the specialty travel clothes and, you know, zip-off pants and mozzie-proof shirts and everything. I just take my normal everyday clothes, basically. And it makes you feel very out of place in Africa when everyone's got those sort of baggy camera vests with lots of little pockets for bits of film that they don't actually use in them.
So tell me, look, the big thing I really, you know, when my in-laws go away or their friends go away, they send these really incredibly detailed, you know, travel emails with really bad photos in them. What are your tips for travel blogs or messages and travel photos?
I suppose with travel blogs and messages, it's good to... I mean, it's good to have an angle. It's kind of a journalistic term, having an angle. It's rather than just writing about this is what happened in a chronological order. We got up, we had breakfast, blah, blah, blah. You want to find an angle, something that's really interesting, and then write about that. You know, maybe it's shopping and so you're going to write about all the, you know, the 5 best places to go shopping in the city that you're in, or, you know, maybe it's food or something like that. But having something in particular to write about rather than just this is what we did, this is when we did it kind of thing, which is a thing that a lot of people fall into. And with photos, I guess go easy on the selfies because everybody knows that you were there, you're taking the photo. You don't need your head taking up 3/4 of the frame. You can just take photos of things that you see rather than try to push your head into it as well. And also the thing with sending emails home, and I used to be guilty of this as well, is just not send too many, basically. Enjoy yourself where you're traveling. Don't become too obsessed with telling everyone else what you're doing. Just have fun doing it and, you know, force people to watch a slide night when you get home or something.
I'm always amazed by people. You see them, it's usually dads who have a video camera. You know, you might be at the Leaning Tower of Pisa or something, and they just spend the whole time doing a slow tracking shot across the landscape as though...
Yeah.
Does anyone ever watch those videos?
I don't know. I often wonder that. And people who are doing tours, and they film the entire tour. So they're walking along, and they're looking at the guy who's doing the tour, but they're also holding a camera as well. And who's going to watch all that again? and an all-new horror for the tourist is the selfie stick. I don't know if you've seen
these. Oh, I bumped into someone with one of those. They nearly poked me in the eye yesterday.
Yep. I've started to notice them around a lot. Now it's just people walking around with a phone on a stick taking photos of themselves wherever they are.
Tell me, Now, speaking of, you know, things, horrible experiences, I have to ask you, what's it like being the oldest person in a backpackers hostel? And how do you get to sleep at night when everyone else is up, you know, being 21?
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. Look, there is occasion when I feel like a creepy old man, basically. But I don't know. I think there's backpackers of all ages, basically. I'm in my mid-30s now, which puts me at, you know, a fairly decent margin in front of most people in a backpacker hostel. But generally, you know, people are pretty friendly, and it's not just a cheap way to travel, but it's a great way to meet people as well. You know, you hang out in the social, in the kitchen or the lounge area, and you end up, everyone wants to strike up a conversation because everyone's in the same situation. They're all traveling by themselves. They're all up for meeting new people and doing things. And, you know, I traveled through Sicily by myself earlier this year and stayed in backpacker hostels. And every night I was having dinner with someone different and hanging out with someone different during the day and just meeting, you know, I spent time with an Iraqi backpacker. I met Swedes. I met Brazilians and Spaniards, and yeah, you know, it's a really interesting way to travel.
And we've really taken off with backpacker, blogger, author and travel writer of the year, Ben Groundwater. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben. You can find out more about Ben and his musings and tips on traveling and his book, 5 Ways to Carry a Goat, by clicking on his name on our webpage and Facebook page. And check out his regular column, The Backpacker, on your local Fairfax Media website.
Sunday Takeaway with Sunil Badami.
Feeling as relaxed as I am? Can you pass me my drink, man? You're on Sunday Takeaway with me, Sunil Badami, and we're on holidays with regular takeawayers Emily Bisland of ABC Open Southwest Victoria and Warrnambool, and Lily Partland, cross media reporter for ABC Southwest Victoria in Ballarat. We're going to go on holidays with some people who really need one, and we'll celebrate the season of giving with a very creative and caring lady. Hi, Em. Hi, Lil.
Hello.
Hey, Sunil.
What are you guys doing for your holidays? You going away or?
So unplanned. But maybe a touch of camping, spot of camping and a bit of family time.
That's pretty much the same for me. I don't have any formal plans as such, but hopefully spend a bit of time by the beach and relaxing with family.
Now, are you going camping or glamping? That's the question, isn't it?
Somewhere in between. There may be a futon involved.
To be perfectly honest, I don't think I've been real camping in a while. I'm probably due for a proper actual real camp.
Yeah, with a backpack and,
you know, and nothing else. Just your toothbrush, your toothpaste, a pillow, a mattress, and off you go.
Hang on, pillow.
Pillow, come on.
And a massage.
I'm allowed a pillow.
No, you just roll up a jumper. That's hardcore. Oh, that's what you do. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would include in that a massage appointment for when I get back.
Sounds like me as well.
Absolutely.
This is Sunday Takeaway on ABC Local Radio with Sunil Badami.
Well, it is that time of year when the capital cities of Australia become ghost towns as thousands of us take off on our summer holidays. But, you know, not everyone's lucky enough to get a chance to swap the city for a beachside town or a bush camp, pillow or no pillow, to wind down. Earlier this year, ABC Southwest Victoria's cross-media reporter Lily Partland met a group of Warrnambool locals who decided to give that chance to a group of refugees. Lily, who are rural Australians for refugees?
Well, Sunil, it's pretty much as it sounds. It's an informal group of concerned citizens, which began in rural New South Wales in 2001. And their aim is basically to challenge myths and misconceptions around asylum seekers and refugees, and also to form personal connections between people in rural Australia and refugees.
So, I mean, why did they decide to open up their homes to people they don't know, and especially people who, I guess, are so demonised in certain sections of the media and by certain politicians? Why would they open their homes up to them?
Well, Sunil, five Warrnambool families stumbled across the Rural Australians for Refugees Facebook page, which is called Home Among the Gum Trees. And basically the idea is to give asylum seekers a much needed holiday and a chance to connect with everyday Australians and the land. And the people who I spoke with basically thought it would be a positive thing that they could do, a way that they could make a difference to the lives of people that they felt were being marginalised. And a woman, Catherine, who I spoke to, told me that we thought it would be a good thing to do, something that would have an immediate positive impact rather than banging our heads against brick walls, writing letters to politicians.
So what sort of things did they get up to during the two-week holiday, Lily?
All sorts of things, Sunil. They took a road trip down the Great Ocean Road. They visited a wildlife park and came face to face with emus and koalas and kangaroos. Spent a lot of time swimming at the beach and in the pool. Some of them bonded over their shared love of music and fishing as well. So basically they spent the time as they would with any visitor to their home.
Oh, now, come on, Lily. What about sunburn and blue bottles and bindies? Because they're always a component of my summer holidays.
Well, these were Sri Lankan Tamils, Sunil, so their skin is rather dark. So I imagine that wasn't an issue for them. And I don't know that there's blue bottles on the beaches of Warrnambool, but I highly doubt it. So,
there are. But
really?
Yeah, there's heaps of them right now.
You're kidding.
Sorry.
Oh,
yes.
God.
Do you know what?
Credibility.
I think it's really interesting because I've actually, my children have no experience of blue bottles, but they have started coming back a bit.
They're horrible. My dog eats them.
That's amazing. I thought they were only in tropical areas in Australia.
Yeah,
there you go.
So much for climate change. Mm-hmm. Anyway, how did the Australian families feel going into the experience, Lily? And how did they feel afterwards?
Well, I think going into it, they initially felt a little bit apprehensive because most of the asylum seekers didn't speak much English. But as a lot of people find, that doesn't prove to be such a barrier, and it didn't take long for them to form really strong connections and friendships with the Sri Lankan Tamils who came to stay with them. And afterwards, while they felt fantastic about giving these people the opportunity to have a much-needed holiday and felt fantastic about forming new friendships, they also felt a little bit... one woman I spoke to said she felt powerless because... She said to me, we can't just have a holiday and forget about it. There's got to be a way that we can make a deeper difference to these people's lives because these asylum seekers have been in a very uncertain position, not knowing what's going to happen in their future. And so I suppose at the end they really had mixed feelings about the experience.
I guess it's kind of similar to, you know, people... Australians love to come together for when natural disasters hit, from tsunamis to floods in Brisbane. But I guess there's always a sense of what's that ongoing commitment. Did they forge relationships with the asylum seekers that they hosted, and have they continued those relationships?
That's a good question, Sunil. In fact, I actually gave one of the women who was one of the organisers a call yesterday to see what had happened since then because I hadn't spoken to her. And she said that many of them had maintained those connections. There had been further visits to various families to keep that connection going. In April, five new families welcomed visitors to their homes, again from the Sri Lankan Tamil community. And in January, there will be another four new families welcoming Sri Lankan Tamils into their homes. So it's obviously been a huge success for them, and they've been able to maintain that program and open it to many more asylum seekers.
Well, look, let's hear from some of the asylum seekers who went on holiday with these wonderful Warrnambool families. You're on Sunday Takeaway with me, Sunil Badami, and regular takeaways, Emily Bisland and Lily Partland.
Hello, my name is Danushan.
Hello, my name is Trisha.
How did you feel when you first came to Warrnambool?
A little bit shy, and then second day I'm very happy.
And what do you think about the family that you are staying with?
They're good. And then they're kind.
I like them. And my friends.
Hi, my name is Neil and I'm 10 years old.
Hi, my name is Rishi and I'm 13 years old.
Now, your parents are from Sri Lanka, but you were born in Australia. How has it been having a Sri Lankan family staying with you for 2 weeks?
It's been great. They're really friendly and straight away we knew that we can definitely welcome them into our family.
What sort of things have you learnt while they've been staying with you?
I've learnt that they're pretty misunderstood and that they shouldn't be sent back and should be welcomed here. They've been through a lot of stuff that the child shouldn't be put up to.
We just hope that they can support more and more people and hope that we can invite more people into our country and hope that they don't feel hurt or anything.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Kandasamy. Or a coffee could come with me. Hot dog, cold, and ninga tatapare.
Oh, how cute.
I know. They were the two most beautiful little girls I think I've ever met. Well, so cute.
Breaks your heart a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me, you spent the evening with the group, so what was the thing that stayed with you about your experience, Lily?
Well, it was such a lovely, really beautiful opportunity to share that final evening with them. And we spent the evening by the banks of the beautiful Hopkins River in southwest Victoria. It was a hot, steamy day. Everybody was jumping into the water, splashing, enjoying themselves. And I also joined them for a bit of a dip. And they also welcomed me to their evening meal, and I shared in a beautiful buffet meal with them. But what the thing that really stuck with me, I suppose, was those children, was the kids and their experiences. And just they were just so incredibly inspiring in how open-minded they were and how welcoming they were and willing to form those friendships and those relationships with people they'd never met before. And they were just so open, and it was such a beautiful experience in that way.
Look, just quickly, Lily, as I mentioned before, you know, there is a lot of confusion or misinformation about refugees and asylum seekers, not just because we don't know anything and the media can't access detention centres in Australia and offshore. What opinions did you have of refugees or asylum seekers before you met them? And did they change at all after meeting them?
Well, I wish I could say that I'd come through this radical, you know, character change. But no, I have always, I suppose, had a compassionate view of refugees and asylum seekers. And that was only reinforced by this experience. But what was really refreshing, I suppose, was getting a view of rural Australians and their compassion and their open-mindedness, which challenged a lot of, preconceptions about them, that they're closed-minded and rednecks. And so while it didn't change my view, it was refreshing to see that view of rural Australians.
Mm. Sunday Takeaway with Sunil Badami on ABC Local Radio.
And we're putting up the Gone Fishing sign on Sunday Takeaway on ABC Local Radio with regular takeawayers Lily Partland, cross-media reporter for ABC Southwest Victoria and Ballarat, and Emily Bisland of ABC Open Southwest Victoria in Warrnambool. Well, are you stressed out about Christmas, buying all the presents, getting all the decorations up, organising the family? Does it seem to you, as it sometimes does to me, that although it's meant to be the season of giving, Christmas nowadays seems all too much about expecting or expectations? Well, although Emily Bisland is now the ABC Open producer for Southwest Victoria and Warrnambool, she used to knock about Northwest Queensland, and while she was there, in addition to eating the odd witchetty grub or two, as she did in our food episode earlier this year, she also met a wonderful woman in the tiny town of Camarwheel, which you might remember passing through earlier this year when we met Grumblebum the beer-drinking horse in our horses episode. Now, just remind us, Emily, where is Camarwheel again?
Yeah, okay. I reckon the easiest way to think about it is 11 hours west of Townsville.
So it's
right on the Northern Territory border as well. So it's basically as west as you can get in Queensland and quite high up as well. Yeah.
So what kind of town is it? What kind of people live there?
Well, it's a really small town and it's on a highway. So that there's a really straight highway that goes from Camarwheel to Mount Isa, which is about 2 hours. And it's the town is just on it, really. And it's about 50% Aboriginal people, 50% non-Aboriginal. And, yeah, it's it gets quite a lot of people moving from Northern Territory through to Queensland. So it's quite a transitional town. And I'd say that there's a lot of people who live there who haven't always lived there as well.
Now, what's it like for Aboriginal people there?
That's changed over time. It was a droving town originally, and many more shops, many more people, and there was a lot of Indigenous drovers who were employed around there. Now, I guess in the not too recent past, there was a fair bit of racism in the town. There was, you know, Aboriginal people weren't allowed in the town hall. And
When did that happen? When were they not allowed in the town hall?
It was an unspoken rule that I got told about. So it's not something that I could formally say, I know that this happened, but it was the tales that you would hear about, you know, these places and what happened. That's changed now, obviously. But from what I know, it wasn't too long ago, you know, a couple decades maybe. But now it's not like that. There's not many jobs around, so there's poverty and there's great distances to travel to access food. Basically, you've got to go to Mount Isa to get to a big supermarket, which is a two-hour trip, and there's not much public transport.
How did you meet Dorothy?
Oh, okay. Dorothy is so wonderful. I met her. So she is an Aboriginal woman who was a really big part of this healthy cooking food group that my friend introduced me to. My friend was working for the RFDS, the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and she wanted to incorporate ABC Open into what their group was doing. And they had started a really successful group where they would come, these women in Camarillo, Aboriginal women would come and learn how to cook healthy meals that were cheap, that they with food they could access, so that they could feed really large families. And Dorothy was a really important part of that group, and she kept the women coming, and she was really, she was the comedian as well as the matriarch, as well as the ideas generator and the motivator.
Now, Dorothy had a very unusual celebration for Christmas when you met her. What was it?
Yeah, so I was trying to get everyone to make a film and they were pretty excited about that idea but couldn't think of what. And then Dorothy sort of said, oh, we're going to decorate our town tree, in a couple of days with rubbish, and we're going to make it our Christmas tree because it's the tree that everyone gathers at and hangs around and has a chat at, and we don't have a Christmas tree and we don't have any decorations, so that's what we're going to do.
Wait. So how did they turn the rubbish into decorations?
Well, I had no idea how that was going to happen. I was sort of thinking, okay, we'll give it a go, but that's not going to look very good, you know? But that I was so wrong. So basically they got, I got a bit of paint from Mount Isa, just like donated from the paint shop, and they had all their boxes of cereal, green cans, you know, like bleach bottles, just whatever they could find around the yard or, you know, that they'd stored up in rubbish. And they painted them and sprayed them and wrapped kind of tinsel around them and then strung them up on strings between the house and the tree and hung them from the tree, and everything was dangling and sparkly and colourful.
Here they are talking to Emily Bisland from ABC Open, now at ABC Open Southwest Victoria and Warrnambool, but then up in Northwest Queensland, about Christmas in Camarillo.
Merry Christmas to everybody. And this is how we celebrate Christmas in Camarillo.
And my name is Dean.
Hopefully Santa will bring us a swag full of presents, goodies. Oh, it's very, very important for us to celebrate Christmas. There's a lot of giving and stuff like that. We don't have much to give because we made most of our stuff out of the rubbish that was left over. But hopefully they'll be blessed with giving stuff to families, the needy families who really need something over the Christmas. Yeah. It's rubbish, but it's looks good.
Emily and Lily, are you trying to kind of make all the tissues in the studio run out or what? That was beautiful. How did it look?
It was really beautiful. It was so surprising. Like, you can only... You have to see the video really to understand how it looked good.
And you can click on Emily's name and on our Facebook page to have a look at Chrissy and Camomile with Dorothy, Dean and the kids. It is such a beautiful movie to get you into the Christmas spirit. Tell me, Lil and Em, what does Christmas mean to you? Lily?
I suppose it's a day of spending time with the family over a big meal and eating too much, and hopefully if the weather is nice, heading to the beach or having a swim in the pool and just relaxing and enjoying being together.
What about you, Em?
Yeah, same thing. I don't really care about the presents and stuff, and our family always goes out of control with present giving, which is nice, you know, but it's just about hanging out with my fam, who are a bit far away from my liking, and especially my nephews. Like, little people make Christmas so much fun.
They do make it so much fun.
Yeah.
Tell me, how did your time with Dorothy's family change your opinion of Christmas?
I don't know if it changed it. I guess it made me realise certainly that the joy that a small thing can bring, and seeing Dorothy say those things, or hearing Dorothy say, I hope that the families who are truly in need get something this Christmas, and thinking about how the disparity between my life and her life, and that she still has that sort of giving in her. It's just, it breaks your heart a little bit. So I guess it puts things in perspective, really, and just makes me think how lucky I am, and just, I don't know, the sort of survival and the perseverance of people like Dorothy is, and the strength is what I was left with. Yeah.
Look, just quickly, tell me, do you, either of you know what you're getting for Christmas? Have you dropped any hints? If you are members of the Partland or Bisland families, now is your time to get cracking. Tell us, what do you think you might be getting for Christmas, Emily?
Well, I asked for a bike with a basket, but I think, and I also asked for some paints and some canvases and stuff, and I'm pretty sure I'm getting those because Mum called me up and said, what kind of paintbrushes do you want?
What about you, Lil?
Well, my boyfriend and I are moving in together sometime next month, so I think we're going to need things around the home. No idea what, but basically we have nothing except for a bed, so...
Can I tell you, do what my wife did when she moved in with her then boyfriend, who's now a husband. The most important thing you can get for Christmas when you move in with your boyfriend is a cleaner.
Oh, right, okay. Well, vouchers for a cleaner, perhaps.
This is Tanil Badami on ABC Local Radio.
Thanks so much, Emily and Lily, for sharing such beautiful stories. That's our regular takeaway as Emily Bisland of ABC Southwest Victoria and Warrnambool, and Lily Partland, cross-media reporter for ABC Southwest Victoria and Ballarat. And it's also her last day today. Look, find out more about Rural Australians for Refugees and Chrissy and Camomile with Dorothy and the kids by clicking on their names on our website or on our Facebook page. And check out their other appearances on The Takeaway on Food, Getting the Picture, The Future and Bridges, which you can download for free from iTunes or our website. Just Google us. Well, thanks so much for taking that trip with me on Sunday Takeaway and an amazing journey around the country, meeting so many interesting people and sharing their wonderful stories all year. You know, they say that a change is as good as a holiday, and sadly, this is the last regular episode of The Takeaway, not just for this year, but forever. Next year, you can enjoy an exciting new program from ABC Local Radio in this time slot, and I hope, like me, you'll tune in for what's in store. We'll be playing my favourite interviews over Christmas and New Year's, and I hope you'll join me then to find out what they are. But until then, I hope you and your family have a very happy and safe Christmas and New Year's, and I'll see you after the ham's been eaten and the tree's been put away. Coming up, Sunday Evenings with James O'Loughlin.